I just want to... All right, yes. It's all Monica. She walks in and it works. Okay, thank you. All right, so I also just want... Karen, can you raise your hand? Karen, my colleague and Karen knows everyone, of course. So Karen, obviously, we worked closely together on this project. Nothing to disclose, no relationships of any kind with any human ever. So how's that? I think that many of you are familiar with the cervical cancer screening guidelines, know that they changed this spring, actually, to guidelines that are suggesting testing every 3 years, not annually, for women who've had... who've had negative tests. It's always terrific to be in the middle of a study when the screening guidelines test. That was excellent. I know you feel my pain. We got underway in 2009, and immediately the mammography guidelines changed, and, you know, it's just fantastic when the government does that. But I'm not cynical at all. So what we know about cervical cancer screening for U.S. women with developmental disabilities is actually not very much. The existing research indicates that these women most likely do have the worst rates of cervical and breast cancer screening. Joanne talked about that. Our study also did a fair amount related to mammography, but I'm just going to focus today on the cervical cancer pieces of it. But a major limitation in the existing research is that it's based on self-reported data or data that's proxy reported by a caregiver, whether a paid caregiver like a group home staff person or a family member. And of course we know that there are many limitations with self-reported data, and women in general are not terribly reliable, whether they have a disability or not, in reporting their own health behaviors. And we know for these women in particular, there are many barriers to receipt of care. Joanne talked about the women's limited knowledge related to mammography. In the work that we've done, we've certainly found that, but we've also found significant limitations in their understanding of Pap tests and the need for them. Lots of fear surrounding the procedure, and certainly some of the fear is related to the fact that many of these women have been sexually assaulted, and so if the pelvic exam is not performed sensitively, it really can act as sort of a trigger that re-traumatizing the woman. And then another issue is that, you know, there's plenty of anecdotal research that suggests that physicians hold really pejorative attitudes toward women with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so we know very significant barriers to receipt of this care. And so our aim for this part of the study was to try to determine the rates of Pap test screening among women with developmental disabilities who live in community settings, identify the predictors or the determinants of receipt of the screenings, and again, this was part of a larger randomized control trial where we tested an intervention and ultimately developed a 22-session psychoeducational intervention called Women Be Healthy 2. And in the PowerPoint, I believe on one of the last couple of slides, is a link to the website. So if you're interested, the curriculum is freely available online on our site, and we'd encourage you to take a look at it. So turning now to the specifics, and I'm going to kind of fly because we're running late. Our sample is from the state of North Carolina, and we had 203 women in the study. About half of them were Black or African American. 13% had a child, and the women were living either alone or with a partner. About 8% of them were in that situation. 40% were living in either a group home, adult foster care, some kind of community-based paid residential setting, and then the balance, or 45%, lived at home with a family caregiver. And it was a range of family caregivers, parents, sisters, aunts, grandmothers in some cases. Women had to be 18 to participate in the study, consistent with the guidelines when we got underway. The women, in fact, ranged in age from 19 to 71 and had a mean of 40 years. Because our intervention is targeted to women with mild or moderate impairments, the vast majority of the women in the study, 91%, did have a mild or moderate impairment. And we actually had really quirky findings where women with severe impairments showed greater gains in knowledge from the intervention, which was not what we expected. So we need to do some further work with women whose impairments are more significant, but it was really a promising finding. And consistent with the geography and the distribution of the population in the state of North Carolina, 3/4 of the folks lived in rural areas, and all of the women but one had insurance. Medicaid was the predominant provider, of course, and some of the women also had Medicare. This is a map of the state of North Carolina. All of the state's 100 counties are shown. The blue ones show you where the women were living, so you can get a sense that we were all the way from the Appalachian Mountains in the west all the way to the Atlantic Ocean in the east. I'm told in North Carolina we can't call it the shore, but that's what we called it when I was in New Jersey. So what you see here is really, you know, very well distributed across the state. 10 of the North Carolina counties are what the federal government terms persistently poor. And what that means is that more than a fifth of the population of the whole county has been poor, using the federal poverty level definition, for more than 3 decades. So these are women who are living in the poorest parts of the United States. And I think it's really important that, you know, so many of us in the room, I think, are from Massachusetts, but, you know, North Carolina has a very different healthcare system and structure, I think, than Massachusetts does. And the poverty issues are extreme. Many of the women, you know, I think were living with families who didn't necessarily have access to indoor plumbing. So, you know, we see that it's not that uncommon in parts of the state. So, again, this is a really important consideration for us. Our procedure, we obtained screening data using an extraction tool from medical practices. We sent them the forms and asked them to fill them out. We were looking for dates of pap test, mammography, receipt of a clinical breast exam, physical exam, and insurance type. Eventually is the right word, achieved 91% response rates from 253 different medical practices. And the data that we collected were over the 5-year period of 2006 to 2009. Some of the practices did not fill out the extraction tool. They instead just sent us a full set of medical records, and then the research team, we did the extractions ourselves. We had full IRB approval, of course, and we also had HIPAA consent obtained not just from the women but also from a guardian if they had a guardian. And I'm happy that the consent issues are really challenging in a study like this. Happy to chat about that if that's interesting, and we've published a paper about the consent process as well. So I turn now to our findings, and what this chart is showing you is essentially the screening rates for women across the 2006 to 2010 period. So what you're looking at here is the dark line at the top with the round markers is the percent of women in the sample who received a physical exam in each given year. So in 2006, for example, 55% of the women in our sample received a physical exam. It goes down to 52%, and what you can see is that over time it's relatively flat, no major change in terms of receipt of a physical exam, you know, running between 55 to 60% essentially. The pale blue line with the triangles, and the line is broken, represents the percent of women in the sample who received mammography. And I won't talk much about that because, you know, my focus this morning is on the cervical cancer screening. But then what I want to draw your attention to particularly is this double red line with the diamonds. And what that represents is the percent of women in each year who received a pap test. And so it ranges from just about 22% up to, you know, roughly a third of the women. Again, flat. We're not seeing major changes, not statistically significant changes in any of these three indicators. And I want to just draw your attention to a couple things. These are drastically low rates of receipt of Pap tests. That obviously is one very important take-home message here. What I think is also interesting is that the women are clearly, many of the women, at least half, are receiving a full physical exam, but are not receiving a Pap test. And I think that that's, you know, sort of an important indicator of what's going on, that women are getting in to see a physician. We also saw, and are not reporting here, lots of women were seeing doctors fairly frequently for various complaints or to have birth control refilled. And, I think that that percent is substantially higher than the percent who are receiving a physical exam here. What else do I want to say about this? Okay, let me turn to the next one. So what you're looking at here, the dark bar represents women without intellectual and developmental disabilities living in North Carolina, and this is whether or not they received a Pap test in either 2008, 2009, or 2010, consistent with the new screening guidelines. And the data on the bottom are from the BRFIS, and 84% of North Carolina women without intellectual and developmental disabilities are receiving Pap test within a three-year period. Much, much higher than the 54% of women in our sample who are receiving the Pap test. And, you know, the 30 percentage point gap obviously is an important disparity. But there's one other thing about this that's important, which is that in North Carolina, about a fifth of the population, a full 20%, does not have insurance. So this is not a straight-up comparison. This is a comparison of women, all of whom but one, have health insurance that covers Pap test, and you know, only 80% of North Carolina women who don't have intellectual and developmental disabilities have health insurance. So even though we have an advantage in terms of how the IOM conceptualizes access to care for these women, we're not realizing it in terms of receipt of these screenings. Okay, and we did obviously multivariate analyses to investigate the determinants of the screening. Happy to share the math with you. But the bottom line was that we found that women who lived in a residential facility with paid caregivers were much more likely than women who lived at home with family to receive Pap tests. And this is consistent with all of the other research that's been done. It's hardly surprising, residential facilities, we would expect to have better rates of care because they're following guidelines in terms of meeting the needs of, you know, the healthcare needs of the women they're serving. We also were fairly surprised to find that women who lived in rural areas were actually much more likely than those who lived in urban areas to receive Pap tests. And then our third major or significant determinant was that women who received care from an OBGYN were much more likely than women who received care from a general practitioner to get a Pap test. Again, not surprisingly. We did not find racial disparities in receipt of Pap tests, which surprised us, and we did find it on the mammography side. That was kind of an interesting finding. Okay. The implications, of course, are that women with intellectual and developmental disabilities have low rates of cervical cancer screening. There is a critical need for interventions to promote these screenings for women. And the interventions need to be targeted to women, need to be targeted to their caregivers and to healthcare providers. And we've done some similar work to Joanne's in terms of interviewing family members to try to understand what's going on. And I think this is really the next frontier for us in terms of really fully understanding all the barriers that families face to helping their loved ones with intellectual disabilities receive the screenings. I want to just mention some important anecdotes. Pap tests can be controversial. There's not agreement necessarily among physicians about whether or not they need it. So I just want to share with you some of our anecdotal findings. Some of the women in our sample were raped. Some of them were raped by multiple perpetrators. Some of the women had children with multiple partners, and we know that at least 13% of our sample had had children. Some of the women in our sample had HPV and had HIV. Many of the women were sexually active, and actually a ton of them were using, that's a technical statistical term, a ton, were using birth control. And it's unclear whether the birth control was being administered to control menstrual cycle or whether it was used to prevent conception. For some women, it was both. What we were really dismayed to find was that we had several medical providers who stated that the women simply didn't need a pap test because of their intellectual disabilities. A couple of them actually wrote that she's retarded and doesn't need it on our medical extraction forms, which was really abysmal. So I'd like to just conclude here by making the point that women who have intellectual and developmental disabilities and live in the community are absolutely at risk for developing HPV and cervical cancer. And until we have better population-based understanding of these women's real risk, we absolutely must ensure that they receive pap tests according to clinical guidelines. Family members often have no understanding of whether or not these women are, in fact, sexually active, and neither do formal paid providers. So I want to just thank my research team, Karen in the back, and folks from the University of North Carolina and Brandeis, our participants, including Women and Family Caregivers, our advisory board, and here's a link to our website. And of course, I also want to thank NIDR for the funding. Thank you.